Hi, I'm Karen Webster, and welcome to The Matchmaker Is In, a weekly series that digs into the complexities of igniting a matchmaker business and the opportunities associated with providing services to them. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Lars Pearson, the CEO of Creditcall. Hey, Lars, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Karen. It's my pleasure.
So I'm usually joined by David Evans, who's economist and author of the Harvard Business Review Press book titled Matchmakers. You're stuck with me today, Lars. He's in Copenhagen, your hometown, teaching about 300 executives on the pleasures and the perils of matchmakers. So not to make you homesick, but that's why he's not with us.
Okay. No, understood. I was just there 1 week ago, so it's a nice place.
He claims that he's by the Little Mermaid, which I didn't realize had her head stolen 40 years ago. Is that true, or is he just pulling my?
Well, I think it's happened a couple of times. Okay. I think at least two times. Not exactly sure about the circumstances, but some was some sort of I think they called it happening. Which was in the 70s or something like that, and then I'm not sure they actually ever found that original one again, but of course put another one on, and I think that one also got chopped off at some stage. But she has a head now, so everything should be in good order.
That's good. There's nothing worse than a headless mermaid. But all right, let's get on to the topic that we're all going to talk about today, which is not headless mermaids. It's matchmakers. So. You are the CEO of Creditcall. You are not a matchmaker. You are a very robust payment gateway, EMV expert, certification. We'll get into all of that in just a minute. But in some sense, you actually provide a very important platform to matchmakers who now perceive payments, and particularly alternative payments, as a way to ignite their business, especially if they're one of the alternative payments, and matchmakers who are trying to ignite their own business now considering payments as a strategic input. So we're going to dig into your observations and thoughts on both of those topics today. So let's start with the role of payments as a strategic consideration for matchmaker businesses that are really trying to expedite this very, very difficult path to ignition. What are you seeing and what are you hearing from them?
Well, I think that there's a number of things that are very much payment related. You know, if you look at the more known players or matchmaker companies, then it's pretty obvious that payments is very much front and center to their business models. And I think it's from a number of different angles. One is just the integration of payments with location services. Obviously, Uber is a good example of that in the sense that you need to somehow integrate location awareness with a platform that also provides for the payment experience in the most seamless way possible. And there are many other examples of that. Airbnb, of course, is another one. So just for that reason alone, it's obvious. I think another one is that you see a number of networking effects that you gain from bridging across the different parts of the channels, which also pertain to payments. So in some cases, you need to be able to do or process transactions online. In other cases, on a phone, and even in some cases, in a sort of traditional terminal. And the ability to bridge across all that with some location awareness is extremely important to a lot of these businesses. You know, there are some examples there. The obvious one, of course, is Uber, but there are some other businesses that are trying to share other assets, such as it can be storage locations or that kind of stuff, where, you know, you as a consumer of that, you, of course, need to know where the nearest location is. and then you need to have an integrated platform that you can then provide for a unified experience in terms of payment, in terms of looking for what it is you need in terms of the actual space location.
I think you're right. I mean, just to kind of stick on that point for a second, you know, we often talk about Uber as the great experience, and you know, Uber is really frictionless for so many different reasons. But the big reason is you can hop out of the car and not have to go through the friction of swiping a card or pulling out cash when you're at your destination. So it is interesting that payment has really given platforms like matchmakers like Uber an opportunity to really solve a problem. And when you think about some of the businesses that you just talked about, you know, absent the ability to accept payment seamlessly, it you kind of wonder whether they'd even have a legitimate enterprise, because there would be so much friction in people trying to pay each other.
I think exactly that's the key word, Karen, is friction, because those business models, of course, is all about facilitating different things in a frictionless way. And if you end up with a payment experience that, well, in the worst case doesn't even work, but in less extreme cases is filled with friction, then of course it goes against the whole premise of what the business model is. So I have actually a very good example, which is a person that I know, one of my friends. He's working on launching a new business, which is very much in the space we're talking about. And it's a website where you can use that for this space exchange. So for instance, for meeting rooms, let's say that you are a theater, for instance, and of course you use your facility for plays and so on, but quite often it's going to be empty. And maybe that location can be used for meetings or whatever it may be, you know, board meetings or what have you, just in some new and interesting location. I'm sure a lot of businesses would be interested in that. And the whole concept is to facilitate that, of course, with an online platform, and then do the same with, you know, sparse location and for other things that are sort of space related. And you know, so he's been working on with his team to get this going, and really 80%, if not more, of the technical challenge and what they're really, really trying hard to get right is the whole payments experience, because he's, you know, he's very, very aware of that being absolutely instrumental to his success.
It's interesting because, you know, it certainly makes it easier for those kinds of businesses to exist. It also takes the risk away because, you know, these platforms provide the opportunity to make the booking and then you pay, which secures, you know, that, you know, closes the loop right then and there, as opposed to having someone consume the service with the promise to pay later. You know, they often always do, but, you know, maybe 60, 90, or 120 days later, not that instant.
Sure. No, but that's obvious. But it's a similar kind of thing. Again, just like Airbnb and Uber, you have profiles, and then you can rate each other. And then you build up a track record, of course, over time that the other party can use to basically to determine do they want to do business with you or not. So it's sort of a self-controlling system from that point of view, in as much as those profiles are being rated by the other party in the transaction. That it certainly makes sense.
Are you seeing that, you know, so there's certainly these new opportunities to really think creatively about new businesses that would have been too friction-filled, but not for the opportunity to make digital payments easy. Let's kind of flip it over to these alternative payment providers that are themselves trying to get ignition through merchant acceptance. And you obviously are in the middle of that as well, because you enable that as part of your of your services. How much do they rely on players like you to get distribution of these alternative methods, which obviously is, you know, what they're interested in doing to get ignition?
Sure. No, but it's extremely important for them. You know, so typically when a new payment method is being launched in the market of choice, then they will pick a number of launch partners. And these launch partners will then include a number of industry players across the sort of usual value chain, and it always includes the type of company like Credit Call, you know, a gateway sitting somewhere in that mix. And of course our role is to provide ease of connectivity across to facilitate as a sort of an in-between party in the transaction. And that way, you know, for them to get the reach and so on that's needed, is absolutely instrumental to achieve that objective. You know, any alternative payment method, of course, is only going to be successful if it can benefit from networking effects. And it's all about reaching scale, name recognition, and coverage. And of course, the quicker they do that, the better they'll be off. So that it becomes a norm and something people are used to using and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And of course, for that, you need to work together with the industry and so on to make sure that you get that coverage. Otherwise, you never really get there.
So you're, I mean, gateway is kind of a good word because you are the gateway to the opportunity for merchants to accept these alternative payment methods,
yeah,
which, as you pointed out, is very critical. But, you know, there are a lot of them. So, you know, there are dozens, and you know, you cover a global landscape, and there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens. So how do you decide? How do you decide how to prioritize through
that's sort of different things. So of course, one is there are the must-haves, and of
right.
course, they're mostly determined by their market share. They already achieved market share. And of course,
right.
one such example is PayPal, obviously.
Yep.
So that one is probably one of the first ones that you would add to the list. So that's one criteria. But then the other one, which is in many ways is a bit more exciting, it's where you may have an opportunity to have a special relationship mm-hmm. with one such company. And whatever you have, yeah, and what I mean by a special relationship is maybe you are the launch partner. Maybe you're the only gateway that is providing this particular service from day one, and then of course down the road there'll be more added to it, but then at least you have a first mover advantage if they become successful and so on and so forth. So I would say it's along those two lines, one being there are the ones you simply must have because they have a significant position in the market, and then the second is all about will you be able to be in a, you know, from a commercial point of view, in a favored position. You know, you use that quite often as a criteria as well. But of course, in terms of numbers, well, you're right, there are, you know, a very, very long list of alternative payment methods, and of course, there are some that only are active in one particular country, and then you go to a neighboring country, and there's another one, and so on and so forth. So the list is, you know, it goes on and on and on. And of course, you can't do all of them, but there are some companies that also provide a service where they can do it for you. You know, for some of the, let's call it the lesser known ones, and that way you can get more coverage by working together with you know, such technology partners in the industry.
Merchants that, you know, are looking at these alternatives are, you know, they're faced with a bunch of different priorities now, and we'll kind of get to the EMV part of the discussion now. In the U.S., of course, that's been a real area of focus, and I know you've been very much in the middle of it. But as merchants now think of payments as strategic, and particularly matchmakers think about the role of payments in really getting their businesses off the ground, Where are you seeing a lot of attention being paid, you know, generally among the portfolio of things that are in fact payments related?
Well, I think it goes far beyond the matchmaker. So for the matchmakers, it's, you know, absolutely integral to their business model and so on from day one. But I think you're seeing that approach to payments spread through to many other types of business models across many different industries. You know, of course, a very typical example is Amazon and the whole payment experience there. But it's so many more, and I think companies, or many companies, are beginning to realize that it's not that people like to pay, but obviously they'd much rather not pay. But now that we have to, we like it to be an experience that is extremely seamless and one that we trust. And you probably hear it from lots of people that they actually buy goods from certain outlets simply because they prefer and they trust that particular outlet, and a good part of that trust, I think, comes from the payment experience. And again, yeah, a good example of that, I believe, is Amazon, as I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. I think that's you've just come up with a new marketing slogan, Lars, for alternative payments. If you must pay, use our button.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got that.
I mean, it's direct. It's the direct approach.
I'm just making a little bit light of, you know, some people are trying to make it as it's something pleasurable. I don't think ever it's going to be, but if you have to, you can at least make it.
Yeah, if you have to, you pick know. Our button. It's yeah. the most fun yeah, of the exactly. bunch. All right. So let's talk a little bit about EMV and kind of your observations on the state of it in the U.S.
Yeah. So obviously, a lot of things have happened since you and I spoke last about it, mm-hmm. But probably not enough. In the sense that if you look at where the market is, I believe a lot of people would have hoped that it was a little bit further along. But if you just look at high level, the way I see it, the U.S. market right now is that about one-third, more or less, of the merchant locations are EMV ready, in the sense that they have terminals that are certified and these terminals can accept chip cards. Then there's about another one-third which is going through the transitioning right now as we speak. And then there is the remaining one-third, which has yet to decide or to start that journey and so on. So that's sort of the lay of the land as it is right now. Mm-hmm. If you then look at sort of the pace it's moving with, it's roughly between 20 and 25,000 locations, merchant locations, are being activated every week, mm-hmm. which of course sounds very impressive, but if you look at what I mentioned before in terms of the country being at about one-third currently, and then you look at how many locations there are in total in the U.S., mm-hmm. which is somewhere between 7 and 8 million merchant locations, then at the current pace, it's going to take probably about 4 to 5 years to get all the way through. Which of course is a very long time, but having said that, in the UK it took about 5 years. UK is a much smaller market.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting perspective when you start to do the math that way, because 5 years in a mobile driven world is kind of a lifetime. I mean, in payments, you know, in the payments world, you know, 5 years is a blip because things tend to move so slowly given the complexity of the ecosystem.
But yes.
It puts a different perspective on, you know, on the time frame, especially, and the decision cycle, especially for some segments of the market that are pushing back a little bit harder than others.
Yeah. No, but I think the you know, there are a number of drivers. Of course, the main driver are the chargebacks, of course.
Yep, of course.
And of course, that is a strong economic incentive for merchants to move. You're probably aware that there were some changes made to the rules recently.
Yep.
By all the schemes in terms of just relaxing it a bit, such that transactions lower than $25 no longer were longer are included, and then there's also a limit to how many per card and so on.
Yep. Yep.
But having said that, it's still going to be significant. That's probably going to reduce the total number of chargebacks in terms of dollar volume by about 15%, which of course means that there's still going to be a remaining 85%.
Yeah, right.
Which is significant. We have Credit Card, we have customers right now that we are taking through the whole experience, that experience every day, tens of thousands of dollars in chargebacks. You know, it's very, very significant for some of them. So, of course, if they pay, let's say, $10,000 a day and after these rules, it ends up being $8,500 a day, is still very, very significant. So I think that will remain the main driver or motivator, which of course is not the nicest of motivators, but it works. And then of course the other obvious one closely related to that is just fraud in the first place, because it's quite interesting. MasterCard just released some numbers that show that among the ones that have made the shift, they looked at their top five customers in terms of size, and among those top five customers, their fraud had dropped by 60% year over year. And then for the ones that have not made the shift or are currently going through the shift, again year over year, they have seen an increase of fraud by 77%, which of course is equally compelling. So I think all that, again, which is not nice motivators, you know, in the sense that you have to pay money or you're trying to avoid something that's really bad. So it's not the nicest of motivators, but there are some other ones which I think it's a little bit back to what we talked about first, you know, in terms of alternative payment methods and other ways and so on and so forth. And I think a lot of companies are beginning to realize that payments is very important and very important to the success of their businesses, and are beginning to realize that maybe they need to change things out for other reasons. And of course, as they make those dropouts, you know, for newer and maybe a little bit smarter payment terminals or whatever it is they're doing, then of course they're including EMV as well. But I think all in all, my expectation is that it's a little bit of a tipping point situation where right now we're at about one third. We need to get a little bit further along before it becomes sort of really the norm. And when it's perceived to be really the norm, then I think the pace is going to increase for the rest of the market. That would be my expectation.
Yep. No, you do need to get to that tipping point. I think that's right, and I think that, you know, it's not just the numbers, it's the types of merchants, it's the portfolio of merchants where consumers are doing a lot of their, you know, a lot of their everyday spend, you know, as well as the larger merchants where the opportunity for chargebacks is obviously quite significant. In the time that we have left, Lars, I always love to get the perspective of those who are, you know, even peripherally associated with the matchmaker business, their impressions of who's doing it right and what we can all take away and learn from it. I think the default is generally Uber, because we all are just so enamored with the experience that they've created and the levels of friction that they have eliminated from the whole ride-hailing experience. But are there others that come to mind for you, and if so, what who are they?
Well, I really like Airbnb personally.
Yeah, interesting.
That's you know, my wife and I, the last four times we've been away, we've used Airbnb. But of course, that has really nothing to do with the online experience. It's more that you get to nice places and you meet other people. So I think that whole concept, you know, I absolutely do appreciate. But I would say that some of those, as these technologies become more common, my expectation is that some of them, including Uber, will find a lot of local competition in markets. That's just my perspective. So I think that that business model is, it's a great business model for a period of time. But actually my expertise for that particular one is that there'll be local solutions that will probably outcompete just from a price point of view, because they take too big a cut. They'll probably end up having to lower production and so on to circumvent that. But that'll be my expectation.
Interesting.
But in terms of other ones, you know, there's obviously a long list of them, and I think we're just beginning to see it. You know, every time I talk to some of my friends who are entrepreneurs, you know, I mentioned the example before, but there are plenty of others. I'd say in one out of two, they talk about these kind of ideas. So there'll be a whole lot more. And of course, it's all about just sharing and coming up with different ways of sharing assets in different ways. And they all spin off the same sort of fundamental idea, which of course started with the big ones from the West Coast in the U.S.
Yeah.
As far as any particular preferences among any of them, I would probably have to pass outside of Airbnb.
Interesting. Well, you know, the one thing is, we've talked about this on other episodes of Matchmakers. It's easier now than ever to create these businesses, but the real trick is ignition on the way to scale. And you even referenced
yeah.
it earlier with your network effects and so forth. It's, you know, there's lots of problems to solve. The question is, are those problems big enough for the matchmaker to actually monetize and scale, and I think that's where the challenge, you know, of some of these local competitors comes into play.
Of course it is, and of course the big value in what you're doing is in it being ubiquitous, you know,
yep.
and you're not going to be ubiquitous from day one, obviously, as you start out. But when I talk about local ones, it's just the ones where the cross-border aspect doesn't really matter. So, of course, for Airbnb, cross-border matters a lot, definitely. But for taxi business, yeah, it does, but maybe not as much. So it depends a little bit on what the type of business it is you're talking about. And, of course, it also depends on how big each of the individual local markets are. So again, I have another example from a very, very small country, which is my own country. So even in a small country like Denmark, you have local providers of these types of solutions. One is, and again, I think I mentioned that to you before, one is it's a service where, you know, you can basically store your luggage. You know, let's say that you go back to the Airbnb example. You know, you land somewhere in a city, or in Copenhagen in this case, and you land 9 in the morning and you can't check in until 3 in the afternoon. And then this particular business, what they've come up with is a way where you can rent space, for instance, in a cafe, and then you can just go and then drop off your luggage there instead of having to do it at the airport or in a train station or wherever you can store your luggage for a few hours until you can check in. And, you know, it's a great idea. It works really well. This company I know is really, really successful, and they only operate in Denmark and actually largely in Copenhagen. So it's almost only in Copenhagen, and it works, you know, as a very successful business on such a local scale.
You know how I solved that problem? I booked the night before, Lars, but that's just me.
Yeah, well, that's the other one, it costs you about €1 per hour. So
it's cheaper
than having to spend one more night. So,
But it's all about choice and the creativity of innovators. Well, Lars, it was a pleasure to chat with you today. I appreciate your perspective on Matchmakers as someone who is actually in kind of a unique research to look at the role of payments in both helping matchmakers get off the ground and scale and helping alternative payments players reach them as well and ignite their own new methods. It's a pleasure, Lars. I hope to see you soon. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Karen. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining in today. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks again.